So our passage is the one we read, Exodus chapter 30, verses 11 to 21. A few months ago, I read a rather disconcerting headline in one of the newspapers. I can't remember exactly how it went, but it referred to scientists redefining a second, as in the unit of time, the thing that they've always been 60 of in a minute. And I thought to myself, dear me, what's going on here? What will this redefined second look like? Will it be much shorter than it used to be, or perhaps much longer than it used to be? What will it mean for Usain Bolt's 100 metres, 9.58 record? It all felt really quite unnerving. On reading the article, however, my fears were allayed. Although causing huge excitement among all the boffins working in this field, the alteration will apparently be unnoticeable to all us lay people. We won't have to relearn how time is measured. To all intents and purposes, the redefined second will be no different. Well, this morning, in connection with this passage, we're going to think about a couple of redefinitions, but not highly theoretical, nerdy redefinitions like the one discussed in that newspaper article. These ones are consequential. These ones make a difference. So we're going to consider then a redefinition of Israel that's already underway. And then after that, we're going to consider a redefinition of priesthood that's coming later. Let's get stuck in. First of all, a redefinition of Israel that's already underway. And this is verses 11 to 16. The passage begins, "The Lord said to Moses, 'When you take the census of the people of Israel.'" We all know what a census is. We participated in one just last year. And from time to time then, the people of Israel would participate in a census. And we can't delve this morning into the mechanics of an Israelite census. Online submissions were, of course, not an option. Whether folk had to assemble at a certain place or whether special census officials went from one Israelite residence to another collecting data, we're not given that kind of information. And so, as I say, we can't delve into the mechanics of the thing. What we can do, however, and what indeed I want us to do, is ask this question. How did someone qualify to be included in the count? This census of the people of Israel, what criterion did you have to meet in order to have your name registered? It sounds like the easiest question ever, doesn't it? Surely you qualify to be included in the count if you've been born into the Israelite nation. If you could credibly claim that you were descended from one of Jacob's sons, then your eligibility to be recorded in the census was beyond doubt. That's what you would have thought. But that's not what the text seems to say. There's an important detail in the text that I need to clarify. At the beginning of verse 13, those words, "each one who is numbered in the census," that's the ESV smoothing out a more intriguing phrase, actually, that you find in the Hebrew text. The NIV preserves it faithfully. "Each one who crosses over to the numbered." That's what the Hebrew text actually says. "Each one who crosses over to the numbered." Why is it worded like that? Well, Alec Mattia makes from it a fascinating and, I think, appropriate inference. An inference which jars with all our modern thinking about censuses, where statistical accuracy and statistical clarity are the name of the game. Participation in an Israelite census, Mattia concludes, was voluntary. You made the choice whether or not to cross over, as the text says, whether or not to cross over to the numbered. Listen to what he says. He says the Lord would have each and every one of his covenant people memorialized before him. That's a reference to verse 16, which speaks beautifully of those included in the census being continually in Yahweh's remembrance, on his mind and in his thoughts. So the Lord would have each and every one of his covenant people memorialized before him. But, Matthias continues, each one must individually undertake the responsibility and make the decision. This was in essence not a social or national matter. It was not decided solely by Israelite birth. The individual decision to be made was whether or not one wanted to see one's name added to the roll. The Israelite nation as such was something one was born into, and this carried immense privileges with it. But being an actual participant in the spiritual blessings focused in Israel, enjoying the tabernacle and the nearness of the Lord it afforded, and coming under the cover of the sacrifices, all this was a matter of individual conviction, choice, and commitment. Those who crossed over did so by personally participating. Another commentator interprets this language of crossing over in a similar way, and he remarks, in the census, the covenant was made personal with each Israelite willing to be counted, owning up to the covenant. Do you see what's happening? You remember Joshua's famous words in Joshua 24, verse 15, as for me and my household, we will serve the Lord. And whenever there was a census then, every Israelite was confronted with the challenge. Are you prepared to say that? The act of crossing over from merely having the birth certificate, having the genealogy, having the pedigree, to being one of the numbered, that was a profound declaration. As for me, I will serve the Lord. A census was thus a solemn, weighty thing. It was never to be reduced to some kind of military project, counting how many men of fighting age Israel had, or some kind of nationalistic project, assessing the size of the nation in order to fuel Israelite pride. David seems to misuse an Israelite census, doesn't he? Perhaps in one of those ways, in 2 Samuel 24. And thus he encounters the plague that's threatened in our passage there in verse 12. No, a census was a solemn and a weighty thing. It wasn't really about numbers. It wasn't about data. It wasn't about statistics. It was about this call to each and every individual to cross over, to participate in a personal way in the covenant relationship with Yahweh. And notice that as an Israelite crossed over and said then to the person in the yellow vest with census official written on it, I want to be counted. As an Israelite did that, he or she had to be able to point to a ransom payment. There's a terrifying phrase back in Chapter 17 of this book, chapter 17, verse 14, it speaks of the memory of someone being blotted out from under heaven. It's the absolute antithesis, the absolute opposite of verse 16 here in our passage. Being included in this census means that you're permanently the object of God's warmest remembrance. Now, the person spoken of in chapter 17, verse 14 is Amalek, and Amalek is a particularly notorious biblical character. But this is the thing. Can any Israelite really honestly claim that on balance, he or she is more deserving of Exodus 30, 16 treatment than of Exodus 17, 14 treatment? More deserving of being on this list of the warmly remembered in heaven than of being deliberately, violently cast out from God's memory like Amalek? Can any Israelite truly make that claim? I'm more deserving of being on that list of the warmly remembered in heaven? No. Every Israelite is a sinner. Every Israelite is a lawbreaker with no right to have his or her name on that privilege list. And that's why then an Israelite, in the act of crossing over to the numbered, must be able to point to a ransom payment. This half shekel which makes atonement for their lives, the text says. So, to sum up what we've said, you were included in the census not on the basis of being born into this people group. You were included by voluntarily crossing over, pointing as you did so to a ransom payment. So you see what I mean, I hope, by the redefinition of Israel. Remember how the census is described there in verse 12. It's the census of the people of Israel. It's Israel's census, and yet Israel redefined. Redefined as those who have crossed over, clutching as they do so a ransom payment. Now, my heading was a redefinition of Israel that's already underway. Because you see, the Bible will eventually be very upfront and in your face about this redefinition of Israel. The Apostle Paul will be particularly emphatic. In its context, this voluntary, I want to be more than a mere ethnic Israelite census may seem very radical. But it's really just the beginning, the getting underway of a theme that will gather more and more momentum, and as I say, which will reach its zenith in the writings of the Apostle Paul. And interestingly, Paul applies this redefinition of Israel in both a negative way and a positive way. Negatively, he says this. He says, you might be the most pure-blooded Israelite with all the credentials. It means absolutely nothing if you haven't crossed over and personally committed yourself to the living God while at the same time clutching a ransom payment that God will accept. If you haven't done that, you're not really an Israelite, not properly. Not all who are descended from Israel belong to Israel, Romans 9 verse 6. But then positively, he says this. He says you might be from the wildest Gentile stock with no credentials whatsoever. Yet you can be numbered as a full-blown Israelite if you will cross over and personally commit yourself to the living God while at the same time clutching a ransom payment that God will accept. You're then the Israel of God, Galatians 6, verse 16. It's what we sang about in Psalm 87, isn't it? God's saying of individuals from Egypt and Babylon and Philistia and Tyre, this one was born in Zion, a Gentile yet numbered an Israelite, their name included in my census. And you can be included in God's census if you will cross over and personally commit yourself to the living God, clutching a ransom payment that God will accept. You must do that. Your background and natural credentials, however impressive and privileged, they're not enough. You must cross over. But you can do it. You can cross over. Your background and lack of credentials, perhaps, they're not a problem. You can do it. And what is this ransom payment then that I keep mentioning? This ransom payment that God will accept. Is it a half shekel or whatever the equivalent might be in our modern currency? No. No, it's the ransom payment spoken of in Mark 10, verse 45. There we read, the Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve and to give his life a ransom for many. The Son of Man is Jesus. Jesus, the crucified Jesus, is the ransom payment that God accepts. Anyone who crosses over to God, clinging on to the crucified Jesus, will be registered in the only census in the world that really matters. Have you done that? Have you done that? Is your stance toward God this morning, count me in, Lord. Count me in, please count me in. As the old hymn put it, I want to be in that number. In the number of those who have crossed over with Jesus as their ransom payment. A redefinition of Israel that's already underway. But then notice with me secondly this morning, a redefinition of priesthood that's coming later. A redefinition of priesthood that's coming later. And this is verses 17 to 21. And in these verses then, we encounter the final item of the tabernacle's contents. For some reason, the bronze basin wasn't mentioned, along with the ark and the mercy seat and the table and the lampstand and the bronze altar earlier. Of course, another item of the tabernacle's contents, the altar of incense, has only been mentioned more recently there, earlier on in this chapter, in fact, in chapter 30. But here now, trailing all of the other items, we have at last this mentioned, the bronze basin. It belongs, like the bronze altar, in the tabernacle's outdoor area, the court or courtyard, whichever of those names you want to go with. It's positioned in between the bronze altar and the entrance to the indoor area, the entrance to the tents. In terms of its significance, one of the commentators who's normally very helpful and very judicious, he really goes to town on the theme of hygiene here. He doesn't say that that's the bronze basin's only significance, but as I say, he's quite strong on it that the priests, amongst other things, were cooking food, and so they needed to have good hand-washing routines. I'm not convinced that the bronze basin had anything to do with that, actually, for two reasons. First, according to verse 21, the priests were to wash their hands and their feet. And yet, presumably, unless they had a very odd cooking style, their feet weren't touching the stuff on the altar. And then secondly, verses 20 and 21 give the reason for the washing, and it's this, that they may not die. That they may not die. It doesn't mean that they may not die of food poisoning. It means that they may not die from God's wrath coming upon them. You see, rather than being about hygiene, the washing of hands and feet in the bronze basin recognizes the same reality that lay behind the sacrifice of a bull at the beginning of a high priest's career. We looked at that a couple of weeks ago. Namely, this guy is sinful. This high priest is sinful. He brings with him to his high priestly work on behalf of others sins of his own. And the washing, therefore, spoke of the cleansing that he himself needed. It spoke of the cleansing that he himself needed. But I'm very struck as I read this passage then, as I read these verses, verses 17 to 21, I'm very struck by this great concern here for the high priest's health and safety. It's there twice, isn't it? In verse 20 and in verse 21. That they may not die. That they may not die. Everything possible must be done to spare the high priest's life, to ensure that he survives. God forbid that the high priest should die doing his work. The thing is unthinkable. Anything that can be done to stop that happening must be done. That's the impression you get in these verses. And you're probably thinking, well, of course, that's obvious, isn't it? They don't want high priests to be dropping dead every couple of minutes, do they? It's an obvious concern for the health and safety of these men. And yes, it is. But it won't always be so, will it? Eventually, there's going to be a high priest in whose case things will be exactly opposite. A high priest whose very raison d'être will be to die. I'm talking, of course, about Jesus. And at the moment then when Jesus fulfills his high priestly role, he won't have cleansing water put on him in order to ensure that he survives the whole thing. Rather, he will have an immeasurable load of sins, other people's sins, put on him to ensure that he dies. That he dies doing his high priestly work. It's very interesting that prior to the climax of his high priestly ministry, Jesus spends that evening in the upper room. It culminates, you remember, in that long prayer, which we often call, don't we, the high priestly prayer. But that scene in the upper room, it also, of course, involves a basin. A basin filled like this one with water. So does Jesus then, as he approaches his high priestly work, does Jesus in that upper room go and cleanse himself from the water in the basin? Does he go and wash his feet in it? The way that all these priests were to go and wash their feet in the basin before doing their high priestly work. No. It's different, isn't it? In Jesus' case. This high priest, he takes the basin and he washes others' feet. And this is why then I'm referring to a redefinition of priesthood. This is a redefined priesthood that we're seeing in Jesus Christ, where the priest doesn't wash himself to go and do his high priestly work, but he does his high priestly work in order that he can wash others. And he can wash you. He can wash you. That's your biggest need this morning. Might sound a silly thing to say, but your biggest need this morning is to be washed. That's not because I can smell something bad in this room. It's because the Bible tells us you're dirty in the eyes of God, naturally. Dirty morally, dirty with sin. Dirty with disobedient thoughts and words and actions against your Maker. But the good news is, Jesus, the great high priest of the Bible, he can wash you. Because he didn't need a basin to wash away his own sins, he holds this morning a basin in his hands, ready to wash yours away. This high priest didn't desperately inoculate himself from death the way all these priests desperately inoculated themselves from death. He died concerned only to inoculate others, to inoculate you, to protect you, to ensure your health and safety. He tossed his own health and safety out the window that he might ensure your eternal health and safety. Come to him. Come to him. There's that great phrase in Hebrews chapter 3, verse 1. The writer refers to the high priest of our confession, or as the NIV puts it, the high priest whom we confess. Do you confess Jesus as your high priest? That's what a Christian is. You could almost boil it down to that one thing. What does it mean to be a Christian? I confess Jesus to be my high priest. He's my high priest. That's who I am. That's what it means to be me. It means Jesus is my high priest. Have you said that? Can you say that this morning? Come, if you've never come to Jesus, come this morning to this death-choosing rather than death-averse high priest. Come to this basin-offering rather than basin-using high priest. Come to Jesus. Amen.